The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Maureen Fitzgerald, and I'm the food editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I am so happy to be here tonight to introduce our featured author, Elizabeth Laban. I've known Elizabeth since she was dating Craig, when Craig and I were both working in the Cherry Hill Bureau of the Philadelphia Inquirer. In fact, I even remember a newsroom party where Craig played the guitar and sang the song he wrote to propose to Elizabeth. So we have history. Fast forward to my job as Craig's editor. Of course, Craig is the food critic for the Inquirer. And my perspective on how all-encompassing his job can be and how it affects all of those around him. Ordering dishes you really don't want sometimes, eating at places you would really rather not, but most of all, always being on the alert not to compromise his anonymity, never calling him by his real name in public. It's a challenge, it's a bond that Elizabeth and I share, but in Elizabeth's case, it makes for really good fiction. Elizabeth took this germ of an idea, and she's woven it into a funny and endearing story with her signature wit and humanity and likability. Craig wants me to say that some of the details are true to life, but this is a work of fiction. The book is not the account of their lives. So that's the disclaimer. This is Elizabeth's third published book. The Tragedy Paper was a young adult fiction, and The Grandparents' Handbook, which is a nonfiction book. And this book already seems to be on its way in the double digits on the Amazon.com list. And also a story in People magazine and in the New York Post. Elizabeth lives in Philadelphia with her husband Craig and their two children, Alice and Arthur, who are here somewhere. Elizabeth is being interviewed tonight by Jen Weiner, who of course needs no introduction. Jen is a former Inquirer colleague who's turned herself into a mega literary superstar. Number one New York Times bestseller, she sold over 11 million copies of her books, been on every TV talk show, had one of her books turned into a movie, of course, In Her Shoes. She's also a dear personal friend of the Laban family who's been an extraordinary advocate and mentor for Elizabeth's career at every step along the way. She was, in fact, among the first readers of The Restaurant Critic's Wife. So without further ado, I introduce to you Elizabeth Laban and Jennifer Weiner.
I am so glad to be here with my friend Elizabeth. This has been a long time coming, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But because it's you, I have to ask, what would you say are the top three things you're worrying about right this minute?
I would say I hope everybody is having fun. I don't want anybody to be bored. And I'm afraid this microphone's going to fall over.
Right. And electrocute us all. Right.
And then I'll spill water. Those are probably my top three
okay.
at the moment.
All right. I mean, I think I got my first real sense of who Elizabeth is as a person. We were going swimming in a pond, a freshwater pond, and Elizabeth looked at it and said, "I wonder if there's sharks in there." True story.
Yeah, that is a true story.
So, you know, so ever since then, I just like to sort of check in on, like, you know, what the fears are. You know, is the sky going to fall? Is the earth going to open up? You know, is it terrorists? Is it fires? You know, so
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank
well,
you.
I like you know I ask because I care.
I know.
So, I was going to ask you to read from the very beginning of The Restaurant Critic's Wife.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Thank you.
We're at a review dinner.
Okay, thank you all for coming. I'm so happy that everybody's
here. Oh, yeah, that too. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm going to read from the beginning. I am standing in a dark alley behind a restaurant. One hand rests on my pregnant belly, and the other shields my nose from the smell of rotting food. I watch as my husband disappears into a dumpster. I hear him push garbage around. The odor gets stronger. I put my other hand up to my nose and hold my breath. I found them, Sam finally says in a loud whisper. His bushy hair emerges, followed by the rest of his head. He looks at us with bright, dark eyes, then flashes his know-it-all grin. He reminds me of a ferret who just snared its prey. That chef is lying. I glance at my mother and her old friend Elaine, our dinner guests, waiting impatiently on the sidewalk. My mother pats Elaine's light pink cashmere sleeve as I straighten my arms, still trying not to breathe, and offer them a weak smile. I can't believe this is happening. 2 hours ago, I imagined we would have a smooth evening at Via Rizzo, one of the trendy new restaurants on Philadelphia's Avenue of the Arts. When we walked in, my mother smiled warmly at the creamy marble floor and the crystal chandeliers. She nodded politely to the two trickling fountains that greeted us at the entrance to the dining room. She practically sighed with relief when she saw the well-dressed waiters. At first, I wanted to ask if she had worried that we would take her and Elaine to a dump. Little did I know we'd end up at one.
So, as a little girl growing up, did you think you'd ever be a restaurant critic's wife?
No, I don't even think I knew what a restaurant critic was until maybe high school.
Okay.
You know, when I started reading newspapers and hearing people talk about it. Mm-hmm. So no, I definitely did not.
Okay, so how did it happen? Take us through the steps.
So Craig and I met before he was a restaurant critic, mm-hmm. But he did always love food and writing about food. And when I met him, he already had a degree from a cooking school, and we met in journalism school. So he did a great job of combining the two degrees and finding something perfect to do with them. Having said that, I didn't even know that would happen. We were both working at newspapers after we graduated from journalism school, and we moved to New Orleans, and he was covering, you know, local government, and the restaurant critic left, and he applied and got the job. It was crazy and amazing.
So what was your eating life like up to that point? Was he cooking for you? Were you cooking for him?
Yeah. I have a memory of the first Thanksgiving we were there, so he was not the restaurant critic yet. And I think we ate in a lot more, I know, than we do now. Mm-hmm. And I remember we were going to visit his family in the Detroit area. And it was the night before, and we were all packed. And I remember saying, let's go out. There was a small, great Chinese restaurant not too far. And it seemed like a big deal. Like, we both said, okay, yeah, it's almost vacation. You know, let's treat ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think of that sometimes and how funny that seems, because now it's not as big a deal to
yes.
go out. I still love it.
Yes.
I still totally love it,
yes.
but we go more freely.
Was he cooking for you? Were you cooking for him?
Yeah, no, I think
Were you feeling
yeah,
judged is what I'm really going for
so
here.
So not then, no, not then, and really not even still, even though he's a far better cook than I am. And I make a few things well, and he's very happy to eat them, and he's also very happy to eat the things I don't make so well, because it's a treat to eat at home.
Uh-huh.
But he is a far better cook. He's the cook in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And he always was.
Right.
Even then.
So you're with this guy who's got a cooking degree, like jackpot, right?
Right.
Cha-ching. You know, like he's going to cook everything. And then he gets the food critic job, and you're like double cha-ching, because now you get to go out to
right.
eat at all these great places, and you don't have to pay.
Right.
When did the reality of that, of the job, sort of collide with your notion of what it was going to be like?
Of how great it would be,
yes.
It's such a good question, and I think I think it just seemed like an amazing adventure. I don't think I even realized when he first got the job in New Orleans what it would mean as far as our eating out so much,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, exploring. It's always, you know, one food adventure or another. Which sometimes we get mad about. Sometimes, you know, we'll be on a vacation and heading somewhere, and he'll realize that there's a cheese farm, you know, 5 hours away that we have to go to. So There's a lot of groaning in the back seat of the car at that point from the kids.
I was struck by the scene. Lila has just given birth by emergency C-section to this very large baby, and she's been in the hospital where she's gotten crap food. She's basically been put on the pureed food diet because it turns out somebody in the hotel, in the hospital kitchen, is angry at Sam for something he said.
Right.
So she's been suffering horribly, and she's in the car on the way home, and what happens?
And so he, it's funny, I can say, because I just recently was asked to write about page 69 of the book, whatever that means to any book, and this happens to be page 69, so I just paid attention to that book.
Uh-huh.
So they're driving home from the hospital, and it's the first time they're going home. They have a three-year-old who refused to come to the hospital during that time, so Lila's really eager to get going and get home. And Sam said, there's a hoagie place not too far from here that I want to try. And Lila is mad and said, are you kidding? Can you stop thinking about food for 1 minute so I can get home and see Hazel, her daughter, and get the baby settled at home? And Sam said, don't worry, it's not far. So they end up driving around, finding the hoagie place. He's gone for 25 minutes. The baby's screaming. He comes back with a bag that she thinks is enough to feed their entire city block. And they go home, and everything's okay. The punchline of it, really, is it not too far late. You know, you don't see it on page 69, but later, Lila's really happy that he thought to do this because they have no food in the house and everybody's starving. And so in the end, so there's that goes throughout the entire book, this idea of, is he kidding? He wants to, you know, explore this restaurant at this terrible time. But then sometimes it ends up being a good time. So there was a lot going on in that scene.
Which leads me to my next question, which is more of an observation. Sam's kind of a jerk.
I know. I know that people are observing that, I should say. And that's been something that I've noticed in reviews and when I've talked to people. I have a lot of mixed feelings about that. First, let me say, because it has to be said, that Sam is not Craig in any way. I mean, Craig is very reasonable and listens to me when I talk, especially if I really need something. He knows when he has to stop what he's doing and pay attention. So that's the first thing. But I would also argue that Sam is not such a bad guy. He's very focused on what he's doing, and it's hard to pull him away from that. But when he's not, he's there, and he's present, and he's listening. He's afraid of losing, you know, what he hopes to, the tools that he hopes will help him do a good job. He's mostly great with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
There is one scene when he doesn't want the three-year-old to go to a birthday party because the people who are throwing it own a restaurant. So there, you know, that does come up, but I think he's nice. And there's also a scene when they're driving back from the shore. They go to the shore so Sam can write about where to eat that summer at the shore. And there's a very nice exchange, I think, between them when Sam says, you know, you're not so easy to live with either.
Right.
And she does some crazy things, and she's tough too.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to point that out.
Yes.
And you're in her head, so I think you're
right.
Rooting for her.
Yes.
Through most of the book.
And I think to your credit, you understand why Sam is the way he is. You understand his family, his insecurities about marriage, and his own mom and what happened there.
Right.
That being said, did you ever drive home from the hospital and have to stop at a hoagie place?
We did. We did. That's true. And
okay.
But they were really good hoagies.
Well, in that case, all is forgiven.
That's true. And sometimes when we get hoagies, I say, is that the place where we got hoagies when we were driving Arthur home from the hospital? That is true.
I mean, what would you say is the most disruptive food has ever been in your life?
Oh, my gosh, that's such a good question. I mean, I would say just when the kids were really little and Craig had to eat out a ton, it was so much harder than it is now.
Right.
I mean, when they were tiny and, you know, I had to be with them all the time. And I was already feeling overwhelmed separate from that. So I think probably that. And also, I did say recently when I was thinking about it in one of the Q&As somebody asked me to do, that if Craig is writing a story about pie, for example, we'll eat pie for a week, you know, for all meals, all different kinds of pie.
Which sounds fantastic for like a day,
right.
And then it's like, oh my God.
So now I'm repeating that because I wrote that, so now I keep repeating that. If he's doing a story about whatever, I keep saying, you know, if my husband's writing a story about whatever, spaghetti, we might eat spaghetti every meal for a whole week. So it's good at the beginning, and I'm always open to it, but then by the end of the week, we always say, I don't want to have that for a long time.
Right. Possibly ever.
But really, it's not so bad.
Yeah. I mean, so tell me about you as an eater. Like, what would your eating life be like if you weren't the restaurant critic's wife? Would it be just like toaster waffles and...
I do like toaster waffles, but...
See, you know how lawyers are never supposed to ask a question they don't know the answer to? Like,
I do.
I know about the toaster waffles, Elizabeth.
I do really like toaster waffles.
And the brownies from a box. And
I do.
Yeah,
it's
right?
It's hard to make better brownies. My daughter is a baker, and she can make great brownies from scratch, but I cannot. Mm-hmm. I prefer the Duncan Hines.
Well, it's funny. I mean, no, I have nothing against a Duncan Hines brownie, but it's funny because, you know, I think, like, for our generation, where parent is a verb, you know, we're, like, reading those labels for, like, the high fructose corn syrup and the partially hydrogenated whatever, and, like, and our mothers, or at least my mom, is just like, you ate all that stuff, you know, and
you turned out fine.
You turned out fine. Yeah. And I'm like, well, how much better could I have been if you'd given me, you know, the organic milk, you know?
Right.
But it's interesting. Like, and I wanted to ask what your kids are like as eaters. Like, what has this? Do they have like the most advanced palates of like
they
any
have,
children?
They have great palates. I think their palates are more advanced, really, than mine. My daughter will try anything, and my son will. I mean, you know them. Will mostly, Arthur will mostly eat anything. Or try anything, and I still like some fast food, and I'll go when I'm alone or with a neighbor. But my kids will not.
Do you have to hide it? Do you have to like put the
no,
Chick-fil-A
I usually
stuff
confess.
Like deep in the trash can?
No,
or, like,
I usually will confess.
Okay.
That I had it.
What is your guiltiest pleasure? Like, what are you the most ashamed to tell Craig that you had? You can tell us. It's okay.
Well, there are a few, but I would say, can I say Pillsbury cinnamon bun?
Sure.
And also McDonald's. Mm. I do like McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And I also like Sour Patch Kids.
Yes. Those are delicious. Those are tasty.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason this stuff like tastes so good.
You know,
they sprinkle addictive chemicals in it.
I know,
it makes
terrible.
You crave it fortnightly. But
having said that, my kids really don't like any of that stuff.
Wow.
I can talk them into Pillsbury cinnamon buns sometimes.
Uh-huh. But are they just like, these aren't, you know, from Tallulah's or something?
Yeah,
like,
no, they just want, I don't know, they just want other things. I don't know, they just don't have a taste for it as much.
That's interesting. That is interesting. One of the things I love about this book is, well, let's talk about the journey, okay? I mean, let's talk. If there are any aspiring writers out there, and I hope you are, because I hope there are, because I think that this is honestly one of the most encouraging stories about sort of manuscript to publication of anyone I know. I mean, it is a real testament to your persistence and your agents too.
Yeah.
So, like, all right. So tell the story. It's 2006.
So 2000. I think even before that, you read the first draft.
Right.
So. Because 2006 was when I found my agent, which was so lucky. So if Arthur was born in 2001, I probably started it 2002, probably. He was an infant sleeping when I started playing with different ideas and scenes.
And I remember you and I talking about it when I was pushing Lucy in a stroller,
yes.
And she's 12 now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's do the math.
Definitely.
Do the math. Uh-huh.
Yes. So this book has gone through so many different drafts. Many of which you read, so many different plot twists, things that were put in and taken out, just sort of in an effort to beef it up. And I think also part of the journey for me was making sure that Sam and Lila were different from me and Craig, you know, to sort of find that place where they were different people, and I had to go through that journey. So I found my agent in 2006 with a very old a manuscript, very old draft of this book, and he loved it enough. I mean, you were always so supportive of these characters. And he, too, loved it at that time and took me on, and we tried to sell it then a very different version. and it was rejected.
What was different about that version?
I mean, I think there were crazy versions. I mean, well, there was one that had a whole, different things that were, you know, there were versions where people came after Sam and his family because
right.
they weren't happy with things
right.
that I don't think worked well, and I think, I don't think I would want to publish that. I mean, I would have at the time, but I don't want to give anybody any ideas. So there were crazy things like that. There was a whole postpartum depression
right.
part that
mm-hmm.
I ended up, that I liked that. It made it interesting, but I don't think it was necessary. I think Lila's struggle and journey is enough without that. And that also was a bigger part because it sort of went back to her family. And so that was in many different drafts that I ended up taking out. And then there would be years when it would just sort of sit and I would work on other books and then pull it back out and write an entirely new draft. So 9 years later, it turned out to be this amazing experience where it was good enough that Jody Warshaw at Lake Union bought it. And it's just been amazing. And I feel that even though I would have loved for it to be published that first month that we sent it out, I do feel it's a better book now.
Yeah.
Having said that, anybody starting to write a novel, it doesn't mean you're in for 9 years and, you know, 30 drafts. I don't mean to say that. Sometimes it's much quicker. But with this particular book, and maybe because some of it is so close to our lives and I wanted to make sure a lot of it wasn't, it just took so much longer.
How many editors would you say this, just ballpark it?
I mean, so a lot. I actually wrote to my agent today to ask if I could say, and he never wrote back. Can I say? I mean, over 50.
Wow.
Yeah. But not with this version, I want to say.
Right.
Not with this version. Mm-hmm. This version was much quicker.
Right.
Like this version, I think, you know, one person saw it who I knew and said, and liked it, but was never reading it to buy it. And then I think that's when Uwe sent it to Jody.
Uh-huh.
This exact version.
That's great. And
yeah.
I mean, it's funny because I'm just thinking what publishing was like in 2006 versus what it's like
yeah.
now, and how social media has changed things, and eBooks and Kindles,
right,
all of that. One of the things I think that this book does so brilliantly is captures the highs and lows, and especially the lows, I think, of being a mom and the tedium of it and the way that it's a leveler. You know, like Lila is this smart, educated, successful woman and, you know, sort of ends up, I mean, she's like, she's a milk machine for 3 months.
Yeah.
I mean, she's nursing this baby constantly. She's dealing with a 3-year-old who won't acknowledge the baby,
right,
won't
right.
even like admit that there is a baby.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you to read a section.
Sure.
This is a snowstorm.
Oh, right.
Lila has taken the kids to visit Sam's crazy Aunt Gladys, and it's been sort of disastrous, and there's been like the poop blowout
yeah.
with
oh, right.
the newborn, and she he makes this total mess on the bath mat that she packs up and takes with her, hoping Aunt Gladys won't notice.
Which page is this?
We're on page 111.
Oh, thank you.
So she's driving home, and Henry's crying.
Right.
And then he throws up.
And she stops she throws everything away. She
right.
throws the bath mat away and
yes.
all the clothes.
Right. And she says, I'm sure most mothers actually wash these things, but I have an overwhelming urge to get rid of them, and it seems like a good short-term solution to me. I wonder all the way home if maybe he's sick and I somehow miss the signs. I bet humming Willa never misses the signs. This is one of the perfect moms on her street. So start with just
okay.
as I hit the city line.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I hit the city line, it starts to sleet. Henry is whimpering and I'm cringing, expecting him to throw up again. Now I can barely see the road and I think it is getting more slippery every minute. I slow down, try to tune everything out and make it home. I pull up in front of our house just as Henry falls asleep. Now I have 2 sleeping children, sleet, and no place to park since there is no parking on our street. When we first moved here, that seemed like a good thing. Now I'm not so sure. I decide that I will just sit here until something happens. Someone wakes up, the sleet stops, my children grow up, something. There's a big meeting about the strike tonight. The 2 sides are getting closer to an agreement, and Sam said he could be very late. I wonder if we'll have to wait here until he gets home. I listen to more Van Morrison. I pluck my eyebrows. I wipe the dusty dashboard with a baby wipe. Out of the corner of my eye, I notice a movement in a window across the street. When I look, it stops. After a few minutes, I catch the lady with the dark ponytail. I have to start learning people's names, watching me through her window. I feel like I'm being watched by the nosy neighbor in Bewitched. I'm afraid that she doesn't recognize me and that she will call the police to report a suspicious vehicle. I roll down the passenger side window and try to stick my head out. She sees that it's me and waves. The next thing I know, she's knocking on my window. I roll it down, and without a word, she hands me a mug of steaming hot cocoa. "Thanks," I whisper. "You've been out here a long time. Are you guys okay?" she asks. She seems nice. Maybe now is a good time to ask if she owns a restaurant. "Oh, yeah. We're fine," I say. I can't help thinking that if I were Pinocchio, my nose would be really long by now and getting longer by the minute. Lots of times I put the kids in the car so they can nap and I can get stuff done, I say. She smiles an unsteady smile. I can read, balance a checkbook, plan meals for the week, you know, the usual. "You do that?" she says a little too loudly. Then she adds more quietly, "Plan your meals, I mean." But I try to avoid letting my kids sleep in the car. You know what they say about junk food and junk naps, but that's just me. I put my finger to my lip, then point to my sleeping children in the back seat. I'm glad I didn't engage her in a long conversation. I just want her to leave us alone. "Thanks for this," I say, finally holding up the mug. She gets the hint and waves. I'm sure the cocoa is imported from Belgium, but I can't bring myself to drink it. Junk food, junk naps. I want to scream, but I can still see her looking at me. I imagine her calling all the other mothers and having all eyes peering in my direction. I try to look busy. I open the present Aunt Gladys handed me, even though I had intended to wait for Sam. It is wrapped in gold and red striped paper, about as unbaby as I can imagine. Under the paper, I find an actual shoebox and open the lid to find actual shoes. They are lacy black flats that look a little like slippers with a big bow in the front. They are an adult size and look well-worn. A note inside reads, "For your little girl to play dress-up." How strange is that? Maybe Sam can wear them on the picket line tomorrow. I put my hand down on the steering wheel and cry quietly. When I look up, I see the sleet has changed to snow.
I always love that. I mean, it.
Oh,
yeah,
thank you.
It just like.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I mean, it's
so nice.
It takes me back in like such a visceral way. Of it's like your kids are sleeping and you're stuck.
Totally stuck.
Totally stuck.
Yes.
How did people in your life react to this book? And did you worry about that when you were writing it? Like the perfect mommies of Colonial Court?
Well, see, that's what's so interesting, because when Lila moves on to Colonial Court, this small, beautiful street in Philadelphia in Center City, she really feels like she'll never belong, and she feels disdain for these people. She thinks that they, you know, are so happy to just, not that there's anything wrong with it, but in her mind, she's coming from this, you know, full-time, exciting job. And she thinks that they're just so happy being on the street and that they don't, you know, look at their email and they never think about anything beyond that part of the city. And I guess she feels it makes her feel inadequate. But it comes out as anger, and she doesn't like them and they're so perfect and they bring her blueberry buckle when she moves in. And she's just completely confused by it.
And Sam is like super suspicious and won't let her talk to
Sam. And Sam doesn't.
Them.
So for a while, she can when she's pregnant, when she first moves in, that's their favorite topic. So they don't ask for anything else beyond that.
Yeah.
But things change as she's on the street, and she learns a lot about the people. And of course, nobody is just one thing. So you know that sort of changes as she's there. But she feels angry. So when she first moves in, did I worry my neighbors would be mad? I guess I hope they read beyond that part and see what happens.
Right, you know. And you can always use, like, my genius line for our people or, like, you know, is that me?
Right,
like,
right.
That horrible person in your book, you just look at them and be like, why would you think that?
Yeah.
And then they have to be like, because I'm awful, you know? And you're right. Like, you know, it works every time. You know, awful neighbors, mother-in-law, whatever you got. And what about Craig?
Yeah, so Craig is amazing. I mean, he's been on board since the beginning. And I can remember sitting in the car when the kids were sleeping, when they were very little, and having him, and he was reading, you know, we brought it along, and reading a version of it. And then, of course, you know, he read different things throughout. And then the very last version, he read very carefully, and he's been 100% supportive.
Was there anything he asked you to change?
There was one thing he did ask me to change, and I talked about this. I did a Q&A in the Inquirer this week, which was so nice, and I hadn't said it before that, but there's a scene when they're at the shore, as I mentioned, and he does this macaroni and cheese test where he brings a box of Kraft macaroni and cheese around with them and asks the restaurant to prepare it for Hazel, the 3-year-old girl. And he's sort of interested to see if they'll do it. And some restaurants do it beautifully, and others are really annoyed that he's asking this. So it sort of works for Sam in the book and gives him a sense of the restaurants and how willing they are to be hospitable. So in an old version, not that old, but in the second to last version, Sam says something like, maybe it will win me a James Beard Award. And Craig said, that, you know, I don't take that out because that look, you know, makes him look terrible. And I agree with him that Sam is so motivated as a restaurant critic, but his motivation is not to win an award. His right. motivation is to do this amazing job and, you know, tell people where to spend their money and not mm-hmm. to spend their money. So so I did take that out, and now it says something like, you know, Lila's so mad, and it says something like, you know, it's not a peace treaty. And Sam says, well, for some families it might
is.
Be.
Yeah.
And I think it's so much better. So of this whole book, 311 pages, that was the only thing Craig said. Like, that just doesn't sound right to me.
That's a good husband.
Yeah.
Well played.
A very, very good husband.
I have been given the sign that it's time to take questions from the audience. So I'm sure you guys have lots of things you're wondering about being married to a restaurant critic and being a novelist and writing about it.
His secret identity. He's been here so long now. Don't the restaurant people who run the restaurants know and recognize him?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. So, yes, sometimes they absolutely do. But even so, he would never announce himself. He would never make a reservation under his own name. He tries to slip in unnoticed. And sometimes, surprisingly, he really does, even at a restaurant where for some reason or other he might expect to be recognized. Sometimes restaurants are really busy and, you know, you know they're not always on the lookout for him. So even if somebody does know what he looks like or even has a picture, sometimes they miss him. But I think that's, you know, we have been here so long that, of course, it's impossible to remain completely unknown. Yes, it's impossible. So that's why in the book, Sam's one chance. You know, he's never going to have that chance again. And that's why I think he holds on to it, you know, so crazily. But in real life, of course, you live in a city and you work in a city for 17 years. And yeah, people get to know you a little bit.
Thank you. When Craig was living in New Orleans, what was his favorite restaurant?
Oh, my gosh. Can I tell you my favorite restaurant?
Sure, that'll work.
I mean, I know restaurants that he liked. I wish I could ask him. I always think of Upper Line, which I just loved so much. Are you from New Orleans? Do you know New Orleans?
Close by, yeah.
Okay. I love Upper Line. Do you know Upper Line? It's just one of my favorite, wonderful restaurants. But, I mean, in New Orleans, there are so many. I know Craig loves Upper Line. I can't say that he would say that's his favorite restaurant in New Orleans. I can ask him and you can email me. If I see you at the, when I'm out there, I can ask him. I'd be happy to.
I'm curious about the friendship between the two novelists up on the stage. Oh. How did you two become friendly? It seems as though there was such a collaboration in support here, guessing went the other way when the first novelist started. How did that all happen?
Okay, well, so we met at a review meal. Craig and Jen used to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And was it at Rouge, I think?
Yeah.
And so Jen came. I didn't know her yet. I was
pregnant.
Pregnant with Alice.
Uh-huh.
Was I telling people
you,
yet?
I think you guessed. I was, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I was like, and, one of the first people.
I think
people.
It was new, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I think I was, you know, like I was acting and strange, like I couldn't stand any of the smells or something, and she guessed. And we liked each other immediately,
yeah.
Really. So that was 17 years ago.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
No, it's a summer. So this summer it'll be 18 years.
Yeah.
So coming around again. So And at that point, I mean, I feel a little bit bad for Jen because she didn't know she'd be stuck with all this. You were already writing Good in Bed then, or almost writing it.
I think I was maybe looking for an agent at that point. I felt like I was sort of like always one step ahead of you in terms of like, okay, But like in terms of like,
a lot.
No, I mean, but it's great because like when you acquire a specific skill set or like you know something, it's great to be able to like pass that along to the next person. But like so few people, like, you know, you can't like stand in the street and be like, hey, do you need an agent? Because like I can tell you how to do it. And my God, it's so different now. It's like, I mean, we were like mailing physical things in envelopes stamps.
Isn't that crazy?
People, right?
I know. I remember that.
And then they'd mail them back if they didn't want them.
Or
and
a letter.
Hurt.
I know. That was awful.
Like, there was no email. Like, kids today, let me tell you. Like, I mean, agencies didn't have websites. Like, you had to get like a book.
I know.
Uh huh.
I remember those books. So, I mean, Jen is the most generous person that I know. So, I mean, I supported her in that I loved her writing, but I didn't have things to give her the way she has been able to support me. And one thing I didn't get to say, because we wanted to read that dumpster scene. So she has read, do you think you've read 10 versions of this book? So it was her idea. That dumpster scene was deep in the book. And it was Jen's idea to put it at the beginning of the book. And that was a great idea. So I'm very, and so many other great ideas that you've had. So, but that's one I can think of, you know, very specifically. So, I mean, you've helped me every step of the way.
Oh, thank you.
But we also really like you. I mean, I really like being with her. It's not just that I always want to talk about writing.
I mean, she's like my nice friend, you know? Like, you're the one who's just like, everyone gets the benefit of the doubt. Like, everything's good. And I'm just like, you know, this awful, cynical, like, mean.
True.
Well, but you're afraid of everything. Like, this is, I mean, like, honest to God, like, you worry about, like, botched circumcisions and just, like, random.
But who wouldn't worry about that?
Stuff.
That's something
now I do, too.
Who wouldn't worry
about
that?
I'm, like, looking at men, and I'm like, I hope it all went okay, you know? It's, I don't know. It's crazy. No, I mean, you are hilarious.
Well, like, thank you.
You don't always mean to be. Most of the time you do, but, no, and honestly, like, it's great when good things happen to you, but I think it's really great when good things happen to people you love, and you get to feel like you've been some small part of that. So, like, I remember when your first book was, well, it wasn't your first, it was The Tragedy Paper, and, like, we had that party,
gosh.
I mean, that was, like, one of the happiest, like, nights of my writing life. I think.
Well,
because it was so amazing.
Jen threw an incredible party that was just so amazing. So, I mean, just.
And like everyone was there. It was like
great.
A book bot mitzvah.
It was really
good. It was fantastic.
Really great. It was very special.
Yeah. But I mean, writers are special people. And it's nice to have somebody who gets you. It's nice to have somebody who's a passionate reader because you and I like read and recommend books to each other all the time.
It's true.
And like. But, you know, someone who gets it, someone who understands if you're, like, trying to figure something out about a character or you're really stuck with a scene or, like, your agent just gave you more revisions or, like, whatever it is. Like, you get it.
Right.
And that's nice.
Yeah. Thank you.
Someone up here?
I'm not going to embarrass you.
Okay. I know her.
But if you say to me, why would you think that? I'm going to know why now. So I'm actually really disappointed because I'm almost at the end of the book. And I want to know what's coming next.
Oh.
What are you working on?
I'm working on another YA book. Well, it's pretty much finished, but it's sort of I'm still trying to make it as good as it can be. But the thing, I'm also very excited about another women's fiction book that I'm working on. I don't want to say too much about it yet. But it's really close to almost being ready to show to my editor. Who knows if she'll like it? You never know. But I hope.
We have a question over here.
Hi. I won't embarrass you either.
Okay, I know her too.
Great.
So this is the really glamorous part of being an author where you're on stage and doing interviews. Can you tell us about sort of the long, lonely, alone part, your daily life? You know, we hear about Jonathan Franzen tying himself to the chair and jamming his internet port.
I would like to tie Jonathan Franzen to a chair.
Wouldn't we all?
And then I would like to drop the chair from a very great height.
All right, so a bad example, but
okay.
How does Elizabeth Luban sit down every day and write?
Well, so you say this is glamorous and it's amazing to be with Jen, but actually this is so nerve-wracking for me. Like this is, it's much more comfortable to sit in my house at my dining room table alone and write. Nobody is talking to me. I mean, I like talking to people, but like that's very comfortable for me. So this is where I sort of have to gear up and I mean, it's amazing to do this. You know, this is fun because I can be with Jen and you guys are here. But this is what I find harder even. That, you know, having said that, I'm not so disciplined. I just try to write as much as I can each day. Sometimes days go by. And if I'm really into something or toward the end of a draft, then it's much easier to put my, you know, to force myself or to happily go to the computer. But I don't have a routine. Jen has a much better writing routine than I do. I mean, if you want to say about, I mean, no, she's much better than I am as far as being organized and disciplined. I think so.
But I think that both of us would agree that like journalism really helped. I mean, I think that there are writers who will really romanticize the creative process and be like, oh, I can't just sit down and write. I have to wait until the muse whispers in my ear. And it's like, yeah, you know, men say that. But no, I think like if you were a journalist and you're used to writing on deadline, and I think also if you're a mom and you're used to sort of writing around your kids' schedules, like you write during nap time or you write when they're in preschool or in school or playdates or whatever. I mean, I think that's a kind of discipline, is just learning to find the time when you don't have all day.
It's true, and that mentioning the newsroom and working in newsrooms, I think, has allowed probably both of us to be able to work in chaotic places.
Exactly, yeah.
So, I mean, if your kid needs something, you have to, you know, it's not like I'm ignoring everyone, although my kids would argue that I do ignore them sometimes. I can see them looking at me and...
Don't
look at your computer for 5 minutes. But if they're there playing and noisy and, you know, they don't need me at the moment, I can write through any kind of noise or I'm not bothered by that at all.
So you work at home in the dining room?
I sit in the dining room.
Sit in the dining room, laptop?
Yes.
What time of day?
Usually I get more done in the morning.
Yeah.
You too?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you work a certain amount of hours
days
unless there's something unusual.
I try, you know, but I think... journalism, like I said, I mean, you know, you sit down and you do it.
Yes.
And you sort of, have in your head, like, I need to get through however many words or however many pages, and then you just, And I think the other good thing about journalism is just learning to respond to critique. You know, like, a lot, I think that there are writers who are like, you will not change a word, not a syllable of my golden prose. And it's like, when you work for newspapers, it's like, okay, you know, you thought you had 18 inches for the story about the sewage board hearing, but now you just have 12, so you got to cut it. And you can't be like, you know, but my muse, you know, you just, like, cut the 6 inches.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. Yes.
Maybe a question for both of you as a follow-up to your comments. What one piece of advice would you give to aspiring writers?
Should I go first?
Yeah, you go first.
So I would say just never, ever, ever give up, because I could have given up a really long time ago.
Yeah.
So just never, like really never give up. There's no reason to.
I think that's really good advice. I mean, you know, my story's not quite as... You know, it didn't take as long, but I remember, I mean, with my first novel, I sent out 25 query letters and I got 24 rejections. You know, just like right down, not taking new clients, not taking new fiction, not taking new women's fiction, just like bang, 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 bang. And sometimes they'd be letters and they'd be sort of complimentary, like, you know, you're clearly a writer, but this just isn't for us. And then sometimes they'd be like pre-printed rejection postcards. You know, to like.
Well, I'm sure they're all kicking themselves now. All 24 of them.
I don't know. You know, but
I'll never
forget the postcards. You know, it's you can't even spend like the 29-cent stamp to like hurt me. You know, you had to do it like for the 13-cent stamp. But the thing that I always say is, before I was a writer, I was a reader.
and I grew up reading, and I grew up in a house where my parents read. They read to their kids, they read, and we saw them read. And I guess there was just a study. I feel like I read something in the paper like within the last week that says the most accurate predictor of whether kids grow up to become readers and enjoy reading isn't having books in the house like we all thought. It's having parents who actually model the act of reading. Your kids need to actually see you like read something. So I would say be a reader. That's my advice.
Thank you. And one follow-up question. Do you really listen to Van Morrison?
I do like Van Morrison. Do you too? I know him. He's my neighbor.
I feel like we're learning so much. This is awesome. Toaster waffles and Van Morrison. I wanted to ask, have you ever had like a restaurant person like lobby you for a good review or try to influence, like try to get to Craig through you? Or through your kids?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, but there is one restaurant that is not, it's not there anymore, and I would not name it, that I hope Craig isn't going to be mad that I say this, that I personally liked.
Right.
And they did, over time, figure out who I was.
Right.
Craig never reviewed it and really didn't go very much. It was perfectly fine. I hope they're not here. I don't see them. And they one time said to me, "Where are my bells? I want my bells." And I didn't. I was surprised. Uh-huh. So, but that was different, you know. And then it was okay. I just said, "Oh, I don't have anything to do with that."
Right.
And they were nice to me. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I mean, maybe without my realizing it, people are nice to me, and I.
Okay, I need to tell you that this has been like the long con, and I'm opening a restaurant, and I'm just really hoping, you know. But
that's really funny.
But in the book, like Lila's always getting free stuff. Like people are like handing her like free coffee cakes and like.
Oh right, you know, right, right.
Like
yeah.
She does get lobbied.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so interesting. Like she has a friend.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Right.
You know,
right.
Her husband owns a restaurant, and she goes over for a play date, and the woman's like, "Oh, we're just gonna bring in lunch," and the truck rolls up, and they're, you know, the husband is like wheeling in like trays of catered food from the restaurant.
Yeah, that so hasn't happened to
that
me,
hasn't
but
happened.
That sounds really good,
doesn't
yeah.
it? I know.
And they also bring a cooler of cold Coke,
yes,
which is my
favorite.
Yes, they
know that you like that, right? Yes. I never knew
that's
there
in
was,
the book.
I never knew there was a difference between the Mexican Coke and the normal until I met you. Until I met you.
That's my other guilty pleasure.
I did not know that. It is a thing. And I have to ask also the is it La Noir? Am I saying that right?
I think so.
Okay.
I write it, but I don't say it that
There's
often.
A very fine French restaurant that gets reviewed in the course of the book, and Lila likes Sprite. And so she talks about, like, they're going for their second meal, and she asked for a Sprite, and she talked about the first time she asked for the Sprite and saw a waiter, like, sprinting across Walnut Street to the Wawa to, like, get the Sprite. And she's like, "I don't tell Sam this."
Yeah.
Like, did that ever happen?
Not like that, no. But I do have a memory of some straw event.
I think so, too.
Were you with us?
I think it was.
I'm trying to remember
what
it was.
I think it was LeBec fan, and that, like, somebody actually, like,
thing.
Ran to Wawa.
Yeah.
To get something. That
might have really happened.
I think it did. I think, you know, all these years later.
There are a few things that that really did happen. But most of it's fiction.
Right. Plausible deniability. Words to live by. Okay, we're going to take, I think, two more questions, and then we're going to go eat cannoli and sign books. So,
I hadn't been thinking about this before, but it occurs to me quite a lot that the restaurant business is such a difficult business, and that even if you have everything about the restaurant perfect, it's still very, I would think, high stress for the people who have undertaken that, you know, that project. So don't you sometimes want to cut them a break just to see, you know? I mean, when a restaurant succeeds, even if it's not that great, it's helping the neighborhood. I mean, it's not just a black and white thing about the food.
I
Well, I mean, it touches on other issues that are important, and it's
political,
I can see that. Like everything.
So I think, I think I can't really answer this for Craig because he would have to answer it, but I think what he would say is he's really writing for the consumers, for the people who go to restaurants and spend their money, and it's never personal. I mean, he never wants to see a restaurant fail. I can say that 100%. And of course restaurants are good for neighborhoods, but I think, you know, and I know he's writing for the person who is, you know, maybe spending, you know, their $300 bonus on a restaurant, and he's trying to see if it, you know, decide and let them know. They can of course make their own choice once they read his review, take it or leave it, but if it's worth it based on the way he, you know, sort of sees a restaurant. So no, I don't think he can. I mean, I think working in a restaurant must be brutal. People work very hard. There's no question about that. But he's not. He doesn't want to knock anyone down. That's never his goal. But if a restaurant is not, you know, succeeding or the food is really not good, he's just gonna, you know, talk about it in his review. But he has the customers and the people who are spending their money in mind, certainly. But he's never meaning to shoot somebody down. I mean, he's always disappointed when a place isn't. I mean, he always hopes. He always goes in hoping it'll be great, without question.
I was thinking about that just before I left. The New York Times just reviewed Per Se again. Did you see that?
No, I didn't see it. I'll look for
they
it.
They panned it. I think it went from 4 stars to 2.
Oh, well,
the guy said
it
was just terrible, that the service was awful, the food wasn't good, and just basically it's this $400 meal that should be perfect, and it wasn't.
Yeah.
And it was just, I think, a classic case of sort of, you know, if you're going to invest this kind of money and this kind of time in like a 7-course tasting meal, you know, I mean, it was brilliantly written. I mean, it was a brutal takedown, but you know, it was really
I'm
interested
in that.
It was fascinating. It was just posted, and of course, everybody on Twitter is sort of going nuts about it.
Wow. Oh yeah. I want to look at it. I'll look for that tonight.
All right. One more question from the middle here.
Well, there was a lot of talk about being a mother and the children. And I work with children, and one of my favorite children is your daughter, obviously.
I know her, too.
And
thank you.
I did ask her this question right before it all started, but she didn't know how to answer.
Okay.
And maybe you can. How is it to be a daughter of not one, but two stars in the family?
Thank you for saying that. I cannot answer that, except to maybe say I'm not a star. I don't. I'm so happy to be here, but probably it drives her crazy that people know us locally. But I don't know. But thank you for saying that.
All right. I thank everyone.
Oh, thank you
for
guys
coming.
So much for being here.
Fantastic.
Thank you. It was so. Thank you.
That was so nice.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.